My yoga studio is a temple to flexibility, and so is my business. Thanks to my Amex Business Gold Card, it automatically flexes with my monthly spending, so I can get extra points on purchases like my Metro card and my new stereo system. Check it out. Let's stretch those bods.
Earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories each month with an Amex Business Gold Card. Terms and points cap apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/business-gold. Built for business by American Express.
Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't no high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons.
It's a love that I find ever since you've been around. Your love put me on the top of the world. Top of the world.
Permit me here and now to promise, as a good comrade and a fellow artist, that I will not report any of this, whatever it is, to the police.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast. Each week, our intrepid group of researchers and music archivists dig through the record crates of the world, finding those albums that may have been lost over time. If a new artist is discovered along the way, well, that's all the better. Using a patent-pending algorithm and spirited debate, we pick one album as an inroad to discuss. Once that is settled, we reach out to the artists and invite them into Thunderlove Studio to chat with your hosts, Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun. When we're lucky, they say yes. Our mission with Abandoned Albums is simple: to make sure artists' recorded work remains, or in some cases, lands on, the cultural radar. We invite you to sit back and relax. Thank you for joining us.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
I wake up from a lack of sleep, starving, bargaining, the sparks discharging, and my mind is turning tricks on me, just like the ladies leaning in Mercedes. And everybody tells me that I better get to bed right now, but I'm not tired. And everybody tells me that I ought to put my head down, but I'm not tired. And everybody tells me that I gotta go to sleep right now, but I'm not tired.
All Day Sucker is the brainchild of friends and musical collaborators since high school, producer and keyboardist Jordan Summer and singer Morty Coyle. Their lifelong friendship and shared experiences paved the way for the new All Day Sucker album Feel Better, containing tracks like I'm Not Tired and Fathers of Daughters. Jordan and Morty stopped by Thunderlove Studio just before the holiday break to chat with Keith and Jeff about their new album, and some, but not all, of their experiences. And there are a lot of fucking experiences. With their weekly hootenanny at the Kibitz Room, Jordan and Morty have been celebrity musical ringleaders for 30 years. They've played with a who's who of rock and roll royalty. You'll be listening to their stories and left scratching your head. Their stories are told with the type of authenticity that only the people there could have. Again, these are only the ones they shared with us. These guys were the house band at the Viper Room during its peak, so we have to know that they've seen some shit. In addition to hosting a hootenanny and having their band, All Day Sucker, Jordan plays with a wide range of artists, as does Morty, who also DJs. These guys were a blast to talk to. Making it even more fun is that the new album, Feel Better, is an exceptional blend of 70s-era whiskey and cocaine-fueled rock, like your Dans of Steel, and the complexity of orchestras of Electric Light and all points in between. Be sure to check out the bonus footage as it drops. In the meantime, here are Keith and Jeff in conversation with Morty and Jordan of All Day Sucker.
It's just the normal noises in here.
Welcome, gentlemen. We are joined by Morty Coyle.
No,
and Jordan Summers.
Morty Coyle.
Morty Coyle. What did
Mortal
I say?
Coyle?
Did Marty I say Mortal Coyle? No, you said Marty. Fucking idiot. Here we are with all this mortal coil.
Take two.
Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
I listened to the record a bunch of times today, and it's great. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And
I congratulate you for getting through it.
Yeah. Well,
we barely got through it.
Oh, come on now. And I ventured back and through your whole catalog, and I have to say I was wickedly impressed by everything. I really, really, really enjoyed it. So
thank you. Wickedly.
Yeah.
I like Wicked.
I'm going to ask you a question.
They signed up for that. They're like, yeah. Really? Holy shit, a question.
We actually expected you just to ask us for statements.
On a podcast? What the fuck?
Yeah. We were just going to make just non sequiturs for the rest of the evening. But, you know, if you have a question, that would be nice too.
Actually, it's kind of a statement. I was talking with Jeff before you guys got on, and I was reading the review of The Big Takeover, the review in The Big Takeover. And the guy who wrote it name drops like a motherfucker. I actually laughed at this one because I don't know what it means. There's even a hint of that quintessentially English wit, Noel Coward, albeit a coward who's grown up in Swindon and found his way into the ranks of XTC. I don't know what the fuck that means.
I do. I think
they're from Swindon.
Okay.
So yeah. So the Noel Coward thing I take as a compliment because he was a linguistic sort of lyrical genius in that great sort of fish, you know, vein. And so, you know, I think that's a direct lineage to like Morrissey and Oscar Wilde, pre Noel Coward. But yeah, I took that as an incredible compliment. And that's where I stopped reading because I said, well, if he says that, then he must be talking about some of the lyrics. And then I said, Jordan, you're on your own.
I thought you'd talk about
the nimble dexterity of Phil Collins.
No, I think it was a great compliment, but I was just like, what the fuck? But of course, it came right after a nod to my favorite band, The Replacements.
Oh, dude.
Oh, you guys, I saw you guys had Westerberg or found an old Westerberg.
Yeah. I got a little bit of flack on that one. It was an old, well, you remember when they used to send out those albums to radio stations and you could just plug in the DJ asking the questions?
Sure.
I had one of those interviews and I just did fucked around with it. You recorded Pleased to Meet Me in Memphis. What was that like for you guys?
It was the coolest thing we ever did. It's because we knew we wanted to record somewhere else. We actually we recorded first in Minneapolis at Blackberry Way. We did some demo stuff. We were planning on recording here. And after cutting a few things, we thought that it would be good for us to try it somewhere else where we wouldn't have the distractions of being at home where you can go home at night. And it's much better. I mean, for us, we recorded like 6 or 7 records.
We are definitely fans of The Replacements. I mean, I don't know if it'll come up at another time, but we fortunate to have played with Tommy there's no discounting Westerberg's impact on a lot of our generation.
My heart with every little thing you do, and I take pride, I couldn't bear not letting you. You showed me life in ways I never knew before, and if you were my own, I couldn't love you more.
Sweet surprise
is what you were and what you opened up in me.
Sweet surprise.
In you I saw the life I never thought I'd see. You can be ahead.
When I first heard Nevermind, I was living in Venice with our old bass player, and I was in the shower, and we used to go to a bar called Smalls out here, owned by our friend John Seidel, who worked at a record company, and they had early versions of Nevermind.
John Seidel owns Smalls?
No, John Seidel owns. Yeah, John
he
owned.
Did?
Yeah, Smalls, Swingers. Yeah. Huh. The Olive. Yeah, like that whole, a bunch of places with what's his face? Was, and Randy Gerber, and like all those guys. So they used to play, this would have been 91, whenever, they used to play like Smells Like Teen Spirit, but before it had gotten on the radio, before it had been played. And I remember the record, our bass player brought the record home and I was in the shower and I was like, this sounds like really well-produced Replacements. You know what I mean? Like, I get it and everything. And so aside from whatever else, I'm sad that we never saw Kurt Cobain evolve into, you know, it's like that thing when you're still complaining about your folks when you're in your 40s and 50s, you know, like, you know, some of the short pants bands of the early 2000s or late 90s. I would have really appreciated to see where he went, because somebody that can listen to the Beatles and then write about a girl, you know, with, you know, bringing that out of them as reminding them of what, you know, a John Lennon song sounded like. I'm sad that we didn't get to see his evolution as a songwriter.
I don't know if you heard it, Morty, if you listened to the Westerberg interview, but he didn't mention All Day Sucker once.
Yeah, what's up with that? You know, if you play it backwards, though, he doesn't make it Retzik Nachtsig Law either.
So thank you, Jordan. I'm looking at the clock here going, we're 15 minutes into the conversation and haven't mentioned the band.
Well, yeah.
Oh, wait, are we in a band?
So All Day Sucker is Morty and Jordan's band. I wonder if you will indulge me a lengthy setup on this question. I am reminded of the Beastie Boys Saturday Night Live performance from the tour that everybody thought they were going to play Sabotage.
They started.
Sabotage was blowing up. They started to, and they pulled up short, and they did possibly one of the most punk rock things in the history of the show, Saturday Night Live. They brought on the first guy to ever get banned as a musical guest, Elvis Costello. And it fucking killed.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but there's just really no reason to do this song here tonight.
And the world has been missing that ever since that moment in music history. Like, where is that rocked up Elvis Costello vibe? And I found it in your album today. I was taken back to that moment. I was like, fuck yes, we have needed this. So I wonder if we can poke into either the Beasties or Elvis Costello as potential influences in the sound.
Oh, both.
Well, George, I'll let Jordad Rock take this.
Yeah. Well, I loved Elvis Costello since 1978. I actually turned Morty on to Elvis Costello. I was turned on really young. And he just was one of those artists that kind of like helped form who I was. I mean, Morty sounds like him just because the voice sounds like him. But he is a huge, huge influence. And that, like the Joe Jackson and Elvis, the lyric, the wordplay, Steve Naive, the band. I mean, we were lucky enough to even play. They took apart Pump It Up and Radio. And
we did Pump It Up and Peace, Love, and Understanding.
Peace, Love, Understanding. Sorry. And with Pete Thomas. Where they just deconstructed it and we went back in and played the original parts.
You know, Warren Hewitt? Warren Hewitt has produced like a pro. He worked on us on our first album. He played guitar with us and he helped produce the first album for us. And so he periodically check in with us and he just goes, you know, he's British, so that's why I'm doing the little Rex Harrison singing.
Okay.
I get a phone call.
Yeah, tell him.
I get a phone call, a text. He's like, hey, how well do you know the keyboard parts for these songs? I mean, pretty well. And he goes, do you think you and Morty would want to come and do this? And I said, yeah, fuck yeah. And then all of a sudden I get a FaceTime from him and I answer the FaceTime and it's Sunday morning, it's too early, and I'm in my underwear and I open it up and there's Pete Thomas in his baked potato shirt ceremony going, hey, oh, thanks for getting dressed for the thing. I hear you're going to come down. So he just shows, you know, Pete the thing. So that was like, what the? Okay. But we went, we did it. We got to play with Pete Thomas a couple times, too, at the Wild Honey benefit. I also saw you guys had Mike Randall on, and you had Ronnie Barnett on, who we know through that group. Yeah, he was always, and even Davey Farragher, who's come up and played.
And Charlie Farragher, too. His son, is a monster. And
Charlie Farragher is a monster drummer.
Pete Thomas taught him. So he plays every Elvis Costello song.
Wow.
We'd play this place called the Kibitz Room at Canner's Deli. Started this jam like about 30 years ago and on and off. And we still do it every Tuesday where all the musicians from the city come and we just start playing for 2 to 3 hours without stopping. It's just a stream of consciousness, you know, pop. And Charlie came in and he's young. He's like 22, maybe 23.
He's the
and,
kid.
You know, and we're like, okay, let's do the Elvis Costello thing. And Morty's singing and I'm playing and we're geeking out and he's doing, like, note for note, the live versions that, like, we grew up hearing.
The live ones, you know, Hope and Anchor and live in, and Houston.
One of the guy who was playing bass at the time, he's Severo, it was from the Smithereens, and he's a big Elvis Costello head. So we're all hitting the obscure live versions with him. It was such a geek fest. It was great.
That's awesome.
So, no, we've never heard of Elvis Costello.
No. Well, he's the guy that sounds like Joe Jackson, right?
Yeah.
Was Elvis Motello?
It's really punk rock because I play with Cat Power and we just did the Tonight Show this week.
Oh, wow.
Which I haven't done before. And
I just went to the moon. Just by guys, if you want to know, I just went to the moon. Just the other day, I went to the moon with Steve Albini. We gave each other a hand.
You bring me a rock?
Bring
me a moon rock. But going and doing it, it's the same kind of floor plan, I guess, the Saturday Night Live upstairs. And to be that rock and to do what Elvis did and what they did in that little space with that kind of environment is extremely punk rock. Because having been there, it's very like, I can't imagine. I see how they got thrown out and banned. Because you're on top of each other in hallways. Like that, how to walk out of that studio in the hallway in the dressing rooms after doing that, they must have caught a lot of shit.
These Tuesday night shows that you're doing, dare I say, are they hootenannies? Yeah, I did it. Yeah.
Thank you.
They actually are and I'm going to let you have that Matt's reference. They start of it. The whole impetus to it, just quickly, because we always sort of get mired in this, was just a place that we all hung out. So the bands at the time were, our old band was called The Imposters. Prior to Elvis Costello, we read out of high school and during high school, we got together at University High School in Los Angeles, West Los Angeles. And right after high school, we continued and then had a little hiccup and then we're back together and got signed. So we were all hanging out at Cantor's. It's a deli that we went to since before we were born. I mean, it's just a 24-hour place in lower West Hollywood.
And turn around, Morty.
Right over there. And that guy right there, the guy that looks like whatever Data from Star Trek or whatever that cat's name was. I've still been waiting for him to bring my coffee. He has not brought my coffee in about 4 years. So, you know, but anyway, it might be cold, but I'm okay with it. Yeah, no, we all hung out there. So we would go to do shows and stuff. And then we invariably end up in this local bar that we all knew each other and it was there. And we had already known the guys that would become the Wallflowers because they were a year or two younger than us. And we were in the same circles. Prior to that, we used to hang out at a place called Dolores's in Beverly Hills, another coffee house that was open 24 hours because, you know, we were all pretty much too young to go to bars. You know, I went to clubs and stuff growing up, but these guys weren't really club dancer people. And I was from early on. And then he's a rock and roll guy. They want to talk about the Clash and the Replacements. And in fact, the Replacements and the Clash, those are bands that the guys from the Wallflowers kind of got me into. I was dating a girl who was friends with Jacob and he was like, we were talking on the phone. He's like, oh, you should listen to this band, The Replacements. And I go, huh, really? And I go, what, you know, what, and I think it was 80, would have been like 80, 87, 88. So he was like, pleased to meet me. So I was lucky to come on where I think is their most accessible album. And so we would all hang out at the Kibitz. And then one day it was, there was just a piano there. And Rami had just joined and was literally the transitioning into being, they used to make fun of us for having Jordan in the band, for having a keyboard player. So that shows you how long ago we've been friends. They were just a two guitar rock band that modeled themselves after the Clash. And so that point they were like, oh, a keyboard player. And then Rami was going to join the band. They had Mark Nishida actually talking to the Beastie Boys. They had a Money Mark first for some demos because Andy Slater, who also manages Cat Power, was managing the Beastie Boys. And he said, you know, why don't you sit in? Yeah.
When he was doing that, when they did What You Want, Andy called me and said, can I borrow that organ that you guys use at Kibitz all the time, that organ? And I brought that organ, and that is the organ on that song.
Really?
It's actually in that closet right there. Yeah. When you watch the documentary, you can see it. Yeah.
Whoa. There.
You heard it here first. You heard it here first.
Yeah, guys, write this down.
A jam session. It became a jam session. It became a huge scene. Everybody, Rolling Stone covered it. It happened really quickly.
And it was wild.
Yeah.
And it still goes on. We were shocked as anybody.
Yeah. And we were as shocked as anybody that it was just like we're sitting there and then all of a sudden it was Lenny Kravitz is here, Bjork's here. And, you know, Anthony Kiedis and, you know, Chili Peppers want to get up. And Slash wants to, you know, Slash. Guns N' Roses have a long storied history with Mark Cantor. And Cantor's, they went to high school together and he helped sort of fund early on. And he took all the photos and get his book. Get Mark Cantor's Guns N' Roses book. But yeah, Mark sort of, we said to him, hey, can we just bring in some rock instruments and maybe do a little louder than a piano? Because we were all sitting around the piano singing. And then he was like, yeah. And it just, David Wilde did the Rolling Stone interview and it just exploded. And then it was like years of that. And then when I became a DJ, it was years of that. And then since 2009, we've been doing it in this configuration again. And it's just, we just do it. And we are so fortunate because there's not a lot of other bands or musicians that get an opportunity to play with their contemporaries in that capacity, like a Hootenanny. You know, it's going to be very rare that the guitar player from whatever is going to want to or have an opportunity to jump up and play with the drummer from this and the guy from that in this really loose little small bar environment. And at the same time, be able to expand. It's not like a bar. It's not a bar band just playing covers. Like Jordan said, we just start and it's like a DJ set. We try not to stop for as long as we can. So our first song might be an hour and a half of
a lot of the core headway. Guys who come every week are the same guys in All Day Sucker. Dan Rothschild, right. David Goodstein, Jeff Perlman, Fernando Perdomo.
Who are also in Uncanny Valley. Yeah, another cover band that Jordan's in with Nick Vincent from The Goddamn Liars and who played with Frank Black and who played with, you know, another monster. I mean, we are just so lucky. You know, I know it's just weird. We are so lucky to be able to play and sort of rub elbows with these people, you know, and now through the Wild Honey benefits, Elliot Easton and, you know, Steve Bartek. And, you know, there's people that we grew up loving. You know, it's like meeting Elliot Easton and then just rapping with him about, you know, he and I writing a back and forth about shoes or suits before we go to do a gig. And then Steve Bartek,
Oingo Boingo.
Oh my God.
In the morning making fun of me like hardcore. It's like, and I go to sleep. I wake up the next morning like, wait, did that happen?
Bet you're wondering why I'm so familiar. Second nature. Guess I'm some kind of mnemonic figure in demonic nomenclature. I'm the devil, you know. So forget any formal introduction. I'm the devil, you know. So forgive me my former interruption of all your mode of function. It's a hell you don't know, that you don't know, that'll serve you better than the one you
Yeah, we're just incredibly fortunate, you know, because you assume when people reach a certain echelon of whatever, everybody knows each other. You know, oh, then I called Clapton and we blah, 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 blah. Right, but when you're a band like us, where I like to think we're pedigreed, we've been around long enough and we know enough people. And then obviously Jordan plays with a bunch of people as a player, and I've done whatever I've done. To still be in that world where I'm like, oh yeah, I got to play. We played with Don Was. Dan was doing a gig with Nancy Wilson at the time, Road Case Royale with Nancy, and we didn't have a bass player for a Wild Honey show, and Don Was sat in with us. Don sat in with us in his Birkenstocks, and we did we did Stage Fright. You know, wow. I mean, that's, you know, I've turned around, there's Don Was playing with us, and there's Jackson Brown doing a thing, and there's, so, you know, we've been very cool. Fortunate. Yeah, there's no, I know people say, you know, we don't take it for granted. There really is.
Oh, no.
And I don't.
Oh, we're geeked every time. We're geeked every time. On the little things. Yeah, every time. Even people that you may not care about, most people don't care about, but we know, oh, that's the guy who played on all the Donna Summer stuff. What's his name? He came and played. Oh, you know, with the long hair. Doesn't look like he played with Donna Summer. Kibitz Room.
Oh, well, Ray Kennedy. How's this? Ray Kennedy, if you don't know who that is, you still won't know after I tell you. But
a guy
came down and sang, and his name, and somebody goes, oh, this is Ray Kennedy. And I go, wait a minute. The Ray Kennedy that sang for Beef in Phantom of the Paradise? Like the one that's, if you've ever seen Phantom of the Paradise, the Paul Williams, the Brian De Palma movie. And I'm like, wait. The guy that goes, life at last, salutations. I go, wait a minute. That's you? I always thought that was like a black guy or somebody. He goes, no, man. And we became friends. I mean, he's passed away since then. We became friends. And I'm going, not to be a dick. I mean, he also co-wrote Sail on Sailor. And Every Time I Think of You for the Babies. But
really?
Oh, wow. Yeah. And this is a guy that I go, oh, my God. You're Ray Kennedy. I go, and I, this is not to be insulting. Probably nobody else here cares about this but me. But at the level that I care about this is wattage beyond if you had a room full of people that cared. You know, because wow. That's how excited I get about my minutia and my ephemera. So, yeah.
That's the guy wearing a Bugsy Malone shirt.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. Hey, I'm a Paul Williams fan.
That's awesome. You know? And speaking of influences, circling back, we've talked about Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
What about Steely Dan? Because that's one of the notes I took as I was listening. I'm like, I hear some Steely Dan in there. And
we
then-
just did. It's funny. We just did a podcast where we reviewed. There's a podcast called The 500 with Josh Adam Myers. And I used to be a writer on the show. And for a while, I was a co-host. So when the record was coming out, I stopped working on the show so we could work on the album. And then he was like, well, why don't you come back on? We're going to do Can't Buy a Thrill. And I said, fantastic. We have a lot of similarities. Jordan and I went to high school a few blocks away from Village Recorders, where they recorded that album. We went to school with our graduating class was Sloan Katz, who is Gary Katz's daughter, who produced all the Steely Dan records. We're friends with Simsy Nichols, whose dad, Roger
mastered our third record.
Yeah, he used to come to Kibitz also.
Wow. Jesus.
Yeah, he worked on I think the second album. We had him come in to do some mixes, and you know, we have, you know, and these guys came to LA, and we were always turned on by, you know, when you're younger, there's an element of them that was because they were ubiquitous with radio at the time. Mm-hmm. I had an aversion to them the same way that I had an aversion to the saxophone solo in Baker Street. There was just something about
You had an aversion to the sax solo in Baker Street?
It's crazy. Yeah, I got it's over scary. It. It's a common thing. It really is.
Yeah. It is. It's like women who don't like the word moist or panties. There's just a thing about being a fella. There's just a thing about being a fella of a certain age and hearing the year of the cat or the, there was something about those things. There was a morose, goldenrod, avocado, rust, that we used to, you know, skeevy thing. And Steely Dan was like that until I listened to Citizen Dan, the whole box set. And then I fell in love with them and they didn't, they weren't as inaccessible as I thought they were. And they became a lot more playful the way that I listened to them. And especially the first four albums. So that's really,
the first record has a song that Soul Kleptomaniac is like us doing our.
Yeah. That's unabashed. Yeah. I mean, to the point where I was like, well, I have to kind of sing this like Don because take it easy, boy. Nothing stays but you. You know, there was that feeling of, all right, well, let me inhabit, like, not at all comparing ourselves to them. But that was the mindset. And then on our second album, The Big Pretend, there's a song called The Man from The Big Pretend.
Than the flesh of an alligator bear. And if you knew better, you'd have bet it was about of earthquake weather. I've been reading Raymond Chandler and I've been listening to the Fireside Theater. Like a private icon in my bed on the cover.
I wrote the lyrics to that after listening to the song The Royal Scam 50 times. Because there's something about that song, just and they wandered in from, you know, was just, it was labyrinthine and it just sort of, it was so much, you know, it's a lot of songs.
And why there's so much roads on that, Fender Rhodes, like on top of Fender Rhodes, just trying so much.
We are absolutely fans. And we similarly to them, the nucleus of the band is two fellas who kind of work on the stuff. And while we have had various players on all four records, the stalwarts that have sort of gone through the records remain the same, close like Denny Diaz and, you know, Skunk on the early stuff. And then, you know, as they moved on,
Dean Parks and.
Yeah. And so we're more than anything, like I said, I keep falling, you know, we're not blessed, but, you know, we're incredibly grateful to have the opportunity to play with so many of these people and to have them still humor us, our folly of doing these songs. So yeah, when I listen to like stuff like Steely Dan, like I said, I'm an earlier records guy. The later records start becoming a bit muso to me, where I appreciate them, but they're so shiny and precise that and people forget they were 22 and 24
when they did
that first record. Like, you know, if you talk about them being inaccessible, you know, jazz bows or whatever, 24 and 22 on that first record, Dirty Work, Do It Again, Change of the Guard, you know, Fire in the Hole, you know, those are, you know, kings. I mean, those are all kids.
I know.
You know, so yes, you could say we have a fondness for the Dan, as it were, although I know people hate when they're referred to as the Dan.
Yeah. How you guys met in high school?
Yep.
Yeah.
Tell me how you met.
Well,
there was a gangbang in the old gym.
We had gangbangs.
Yeah, we weren't at it. We were just handing out flyers on Melrose for the old gangbang with a key at the end of bang.
And yeah, I got his keys at the key party, and we went home. And
Mrs. Fox English class. I think it may have been first time period.
Okay. Yeah, and I was in a band with Jordan Zevon, who was Warren Zevon's son, and okay.
and the sixth sucker for all intents and purposes.
He's on all of our stuff,
and we help write his record
with his record too. And so I came in, and I had a set list, and I think he had headphones on, because that's what you do in English class, is wear headphones and not pay attention. And then he knew all the songs, and we needed a singer, and so he came up and joined, and we quickly like ditched all the covers and started writing originals and performing them at school, which was kind of ballsy to do in 11th grade.
Yeah. And we had
we really kind of didn't do covers until like later in life. We would do them.
We did covers up. We would do covers in the garage at Jordan Zevon's grandmother's house. And then, I think we knew early on that it was going to be, you know, it's weird because I think about that occasion where I'm like, what was the, you know, you're in a band in high school and, you know, a high school band, you know, you play, you know, Louie, whatever the fuck. But the type of music that was out, once again, had we been from an era or had we aspired to be like a punk rock band, which we never were, it would have just been what it would have been. It would have been the three chord, you know, whatever that thing is. But, you know, Jordan's a keyboard player. So right off the bat, we have a certain melodic leveling of what there is. There is only so much punk rock you're going to do with, you know, a piano player. So we were also fortunate to be at the perfect timing for like XTC Skylarking. And, you know, and then the Dukes of Stratosphere records. And then the sort of revival of like, you know, Bourgeois Tag. And, you know, a lot of these bands that you could say Beatle-y, but, you know, the ones at World Party, the World Party albums when those first came out. And, you know, we had been influenced by MTV and stuff like that. But right as we were loving this melodic with sensibilities that were very attuned to us, Squeeze and, you know, Billy Joel and Elvis Costello and Joe Jackson. And, you know, and then to a degree,
the Police and U2 and all.
Yeah, oh God. You know, I mean, and then it was Fishbone and Oingo Boingo, local bands that we thought the world knew. You know, we thought everybody knew who Oingo Boingo was. I had no idea. And, you know, and Danny went to our high school. Danny and Richard went to our high school, you know, years before. So there was always this local hero. And then we would do jams, and Angelo from Fishbone would tell poetry in between our sets and then play saxophone in between our sets. And, you know, they were only a few years older, but they were as accomplished and they meant as much to us as then the Chili Peppers, you know, when they were younger, you know, they were breaking, they hadn't broken yet. And we would see all these people, Trulio Disgracius and all these like sort of local legend, you know, and then, you know, configurations of these things. So then the Kibitz was also our version of that. It was, where can we all hang out with these other people of sort of like-minded musicality that loves this?
There was a lot of heavy metal. There was a big heavy metal scene.
Yeah, the heavy metal thing went.
Where we were playing with these bands, and obviously we were the square peg because I play keyboards.
Yeah, God,
and
dude.
So we kind of retreated into that scene with everybody else, and then it kind of swooped back around to us.
Yes,
late,
and we like to think we single handedly, not grunge, put an end to hair metal in Los Angeles
by ourselves.
As a cottage industry. That was us.
Yes,
that was us. We refused to wear pants tighter than the ones we were already wearing. So yeah, no, we came at that time when we didn't have a lot of alternatives. We played coffee houses, and there was a really big coffee house scene also, which a lot of bands sort of came out of. You guys had Steve Isaacs on, right?
Yep.
You guys, yeah, yep. Steve's an old friend when he used to go by Spooky, and he did a jam at a place called Mad Hatters on Pico in Los Angeles. And in between, right when the Imposters had broken up the first time and our guitar player went to Berklee and School of Music, and then, you know, we sort of had like, and then we got back together and started getting signed. We played coffee houses, And Steve had an open mic night. It was Spooky's open mic night there in Highland Grounds, another place used to be on Highlands. And it was a huge coffee house scene. And from there, we met Chucky Weiss from Chucky Weiss and the Goddamn Liars, who then was like, you need to play at the Central. And we'd driven by the Central our whole lives, but we were too young to go. And then we were just 21, whatever it was. And we started opening for Chucky Weiss on Monday nights. And then we got kind of a residency there. And then when Johnny and Sal, when Johnny Depp bought it, we got brought over as we had
the house band for the Viper.
Monday night. Yeah. And we always did that. We were the house band at the Roxbury, the original Roxbury on Sunset, which is now Pink Taco. And it was
Pink Taco.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was the Roxbury, the famous. And prior to that, it was the Imperial Gardens. If you ever watch the punk rock documentaries from like the 70s and 80s, it was a huge punk. And then it was, you know, Frank Sinatra and everybody else. And it was a drug den. But by then it was the Roxbury. And we were the house band there. We were the house band at a few different places. And we just knew to stay in one place and let the world come to us. And, you know,
also, we didn't want to lift and carry.
Yeah, that was the thing, too. You know, but we, you know, and we, you know, we saw it, how it worked for the Doors. We saw how it worked for, you know, a few of these different bands where you just became, you know, it's like people that play Vegas now. They got smart and they're like, well, I could tour the world, but why schlep? You know what I mean? I could be here. And if once you get to a point, people come to you. And the Viper at the time had such a cachet that there were people there every night, no matter what happened.
I was watching an interview with Adam Duritz, and he said it was the Viper room that saved his life, essentially, after that first record, because he was a bartender there. He didn't take any tips or anything, but that's how he would get away from it. All right. No, come on. Come on.
No, we know.
He did 10 bar.
We met Adam right when he came to town. So we met Counting Crows, and Adam first came to town. And I remember reading the Rolling Stone article right when he was on the cover of Rolling Stone while he was hanging out there. And people would like walk up to him and be like, why are you ripping out Van Morrison? You know, like shitty things people say just to be a dick and, you know, and everything. So he was hanging out with really cool, you know, Viper was incredibly, I don't know how to, I mean, the fact that Johnny owned it, but you literally saw everybody there.
Everybody.
Whether they were on stage, you know, like, oh, the Chili Peppers just got Dave Navarro in the band. They're playing a secret gig tonight. You guys want to go? Oh, yeah, cool. Jordan and I are sitting at a booth, and it curtain opens, and it's the Chili Peppers. Or I introduced Perry, you know, Porno for Pyros at a gig. Okay. Or, you know, you'd see Hunter Thompson or Elvis Costello walked in, you know, and you're just like, oh, wow. You know, and so it was like that every night. Not
and Montench would get up and play with us.
Yeah,
and,
it's not hyperbole. Yeah, during the day, Johnny would just be playing guitar. Chrissy Hynde would just walk in barefoot, and you'd be like, "Oh, okay, that's the night it's going to be." So with that, we were just in a place like that. So I remember reading the Rolling Stone article, and it was like the first paragraph said something about him being Jewish. And, you know, we're all Jewish in the band. And I just thought it was so weird that Rolling Stone, it didn't seem to be germane to the conversation about him. But it was weird. It was like, you know, blah, 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 the Jewish front man of.
Certainly wasn't German.
And I went, what? And I said to him, I said, and, you know, I don't, from my end, it was sort of like me going up to him and going, yeah, I thought that was really weird. Like, you're like this Bay Area Jewish singer of. And I thought, I don't think their music is, it's not like Modest Yahoo or anything. I didn't think that it lent itself to that. And I thought that was, even if David wrote the article or a Jew wrote the article, I thought it was such a weird thing to bring
up.
You
know what you guys need? You need clarinet in your band.
That's you guys should have an accordion and a clarinet. As Gene Simmons said to Mike Chapman before we worked with him, you should work with the Jews.
What? Wait, what?
Yeah. That was the plain conversation, you know, work with some Jews, you know, which, and we agree, you know, we, as our band, we absolutely agree, but yeah, no, it was just a very funny thing. And so we met him there and we all became friends. And then, Dan Rothschild and I sang on a record by a band called Joe 90, which Adam Hamilton and a bunch of guys that came out of, a band called what were they called? Chromium. No, not, I forgot what they were called, but they, Joe 90 came out of it. God's Child. They were like a New York band. And then they became Joe 90 and they were signed to Adam's label. And so Dan and I sang on a song on that album. Everybody was in the same kind of court.
Is Dan Rothschild the son of Paul Rothschild? Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Another guest of ours, Chad Fisher.
Oh, yeah.
Worked with Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. And as well as Dan produced our third album, and he also produced the Better Than Ezra record.
He's played with everybody from Beck, Shakira.
He produced I worked on the last Heart record.
Heart, yeah.
Yeah. And he was bass player in Heart, and he played bass with Beck and Shakira and a bunch of people. And, you know, in that Steely Dan way, we're lucky. The people around us are like so old. I always say, let me be the least talented person on stage and we'll do okay.
How's that working out for you?
I'm terrible.
It could be better.
And I lower the bar so frequently that we could literally have somebody come on stage. The Nairobi Trio could come on stage and I could make them look like Steely Dan.
A quartet. You could make them a quartet if you just.
I could.
Yeah.
Sat out in the sun a little bit more.
Jeff, I see you leaning in there.
I may need a minute with that one.
Oh, by the way, Al, you're wearing a Green Day shirt. I'll tell you a great Green Day story. I DJed at a place called The Standard, a purple room at The Standard, and a million people came there, and it was a rock and roll sort. And one night, Billy and Mike were being bothered by Andy Dick, and they were like,
who is it?
They said, I know, right? They said, hey, can you give, we're staying at the Marquee, which is sort of around the corner. And I said, yeah, I got some stuff in the car. Why don't you guys jump in the backseat? I'll drive you back to the hotel. And I drove back to the hotel playing Down by the Seaside by Led Zeppelin in the car. And we were all in the car like, Down by the Seaside. And I'm looking back and in my rear view, I'm looking at Billy Joe and Mike in the backseat, like, and we're all just singing along with Led Zeppelin. Nice. And I always remember that. And one time I met Joe Strummer there. I was DJing and they brought Joe happened to be there, Brian Ferry and a bunch of people. And you think that guy wrote the article, drop names. Ha! He's an amateur.
Yeah, really. Let me get the vacuum cleaner to clean all the names up.
This is one of my favorite stories, because obviously a huge fan of the Clash and everything. As the only podcast that matters would know, the only band that matters. And
thank you.
Yeah. You
just made Keith's whole fucking year.
By the way, this podcast kills fascists. We'll give you that one as well.
I have a good. You can. Don't.
And Jordan has a Woody.
Don't encourage him, please. Morty. Yeah.
I'm there and I'm DJing. So I start playing old rock steady stuff. And old ska stuff, and he's dancing on the table. And they said, "Do you mind staying after and keep going?" And I go, "No, absolutely not. I mean, the joy you've given me, no, absolutely not." And the bar clears out, and it's just, 10, 15 people, maybe Axel, whoever was there, and they're just grooving along. And I'm playing all this stuff. So then I put on a Zeppelin song. And I'm talking about, I played Big Audio Dynamite. Like, I was testing to see if he would respond to mix stuff. And to Clash stuff, and I played all this stuff. And then the guy came up to me and said, Joe loves everything you're doing. You lost him with Led Zeppelin. Uh-huh. And I went, oh, okay. And so later on, that ends down, and I walk in the room. They go, Joe wants to meet you. So I walk over, and I'm sitting with him, and I'm talking. And then he goes, oh, man, I love everything you're playing. And I said, yeah, I heard I lost you with Led Zeppelin. And he goes, I fucking love Led Zeppelin. And I was like, what? Like, to hear Joe Strummer, I don't care if he was drunk or in what context that was. It was right before the Mescaleros were going to play the Troubadour. And he was there with that band. And I just sat there. And that's one of those moments where just sitting with Joe Strummer and he says, I fucking love Led Zeppelin. I went, dude, I've never been in the right, better place at the better time to hear, one of these kings of punk rock, not slag a band that made punk rock by their very existence, to have somebody say, so listening to Steve Jones, when you hear Jonesy talk about how much he loves so much of the stuff that people had pitted them against and thought that they were the antithesis of all of these rock bands, and then to hear them basically come out and genuflect in the same way that we do, right. You know, that's when I got to the age where I said, you know what? I love Billy Joel. Fuck you. It's unabashed. Nylon Curtain's one of my favorite albums. You know, Glass Houses is hands down one of my favorite albums of all time. You know,
and stop him before he goes down the Billy Joel hole.
I will never abandon.
Wait, Billy. There's a joke in there somewhere, Jordan.
Yeah. No, but he's also, you know, he's also the greatest to me, the greatest songwriter, the greatest American standard songwriter of the end of the 20th century. There's nobody better than him personally, by himself. Yes, Stevie Wonder's fantastic. Yes, there's other people, but as the lyricist
and the writer. Till he's done with the Billy Joel thing.
No, I'm done. No, I'm done. And by the way, my love for Billy Joel comes in bulk too. So, warehouse size carnage.
Carrying member, yes.
Not touching it. I'm not touching.
I'm a Costco dependent. In a complicated relationship with Trader Joe's.
Reel it back in.
Reel it back in. All right, let's talk about the album.
What album?
As I listened to, you know, 12 songs, I broke it into three acts. And I want to start asking about specific songs. Yeah. Start of the second act. I feel like the album takes a turn with Fathers of Daughters into something. I was like, everything up until then was playful and fun and, you know, a little punk tinged, very pop influenced. And then Fathers of Daughters, I was like, hang on. This guy's pretty slick with a pen.
How can I quite find the right words for what it meant when she entered into my world? It's like they gave me a daughter and traded my heart for a lifetime of nights.
The last record was about domestic bliss, and then things went incredibly wrong in many different ways between these records. So this record, because it's called Feel Better, came out of Jordan and I going back and forth and sort of saying that to each other and to so many friends through the pandemic and through tragic circumstances and through us getting sick and us getting well and getting sick again, and that this was supposed to be the record that sort of talked about the loss. And there was all of this stuff. And so when Jordan gave me this melody, I knew there was something beautiful there. And I knew it had to me, it sounded like maybe like John Lennon, something like Beautiful Boy, or it was something off of Double Fantasy. He'd gone through a lot of his life and he wanted to get back to doing what he did, Watching the Wheels or even Real Love, you know, even like this sort of stuff. So I said, you know, I really like to write this song. I don't know of any song that talks about being the father of a daughter. You know, and I think just the title alone establishes a baseline understanding of what it's about. And then I said, now what's my experience with this? And what else is there? It's not just I like dressing you up in little dresses and combing your hair. There's something else there. There's a quality of being a man and having a daughter. And there's a part of, you know, softening. And there's also a part of looking how women are treated, how you look at your own life. You know, Jordan has got boys, and there's a certain sense of that too. The first time I showed my daughter, who was probably 10 at the time, I showed her the lyrics without knowing the melody. And I just said, here's the lyrics to the song. And she cried. And I said, okay, I think that's effective. And, you know, what the point wasn't to make it, you know, after you've been writing for a long time, you know, the way to manipulate people. I didn't want it to be manipulative. I wanted it just to be as the way when I heard like Beautiful Boy or Watching the Wheels or any of those songs, I didn't feel manipulated. I didn't feel like, even though I knew that Lennon could be incredibly sloganeering with, you know, imagine it. I felt that he was just trying to be as honest as he could be, and he couldn't help himself from being Lennon.
Right.
So he couldn't help himself from dropping in.
Gentlemen, we're at time.
Oh, I'm so sorry. What other songs did you like?
Pencils Down.
Real quick. Pencils Down. I was going to dip into my co-host's ink and borrow a question from his satchel, which is on the Hell You Don't Know, I Wonder If We Dated the Same Woman.
That's about me, I think. It's more about how I look at
did we date?
Must look at. Well, we might have. We might have. Wait, hold on. Let me look at the C's in my. It's going to take me a while.
Yeah.
I really love the idea of having, you know, the Faustian kind of thing. I love that there was Sympathy for the Devil, and then there was Devil Went Down to Georgia, and then there was, and Jordan sent me something that had I'm the Devil, you know, he had like a thing like that. And I went, oh, I don't think you meant it like this. But what you're basically saying is, I'm talking to somebody else and I'm basically going, why didn't you just stay with me? I'm the crap you already know about. You know, like you've already made your Faustian bargain with me. You know, why don't you just stay with the devil you already know, then go back out there to the devils that are available, you know, well, and so it's Jeff, from the devil's perspective. And remember, the devil was the fallen angel and he falls back on that all the time. You know what I mean? He's not a bad guy. He just, you know, there were certain things that happened. So anyway, yeah. So yes, we probably did. Well, it all depends. We can compare notes afterward, or you can.
We
Google.
Should. And then I'll confess, my favorite song on the record is Hardly Any Wonder.
Oh wow!
Oh, wow!
I'm cool. Glad somebody found that.
I thought I belonged without. So relieved you cast long shadows beyond my doubt. I got over almost anything I got through. I got under everything after I lost you. There's hardly any wonder that's left. A spell if you just can't say. Incantations, three little magic words fell away. Misdirection, your sleight of handiwork broke our back.
It's back to back with The Hell You Don't Know because they're the most theatrical. And that's where I say, like, hey, if you're out there, first of all, if you're Robbie Williams and you're out there, God let us work with you and write hits for America so you finally crack America because you deserve to after all these years. And I've said that to him. Secondly, ultimately, I think we'd like to do musicals. And I think that was a dry run with the stuff that we've done by going, yeah, I think we write a little bigger than in the milieu just of pop music, you know, not blowing ourselves. I'm saying is I just think it lends itself to that picture. And so
we don't shy away from getting, you know, if that's the way that where the song is going, we will go there. And
yeah, I like that it could
song.
Be a
but
part.
I'm glad you like that because that was like one of my favorite ones. There's certain songs that are tipping points for like a record, like, okay,
yeah, some of the most orchestrated.
We have a record now.
No, it's an incredible tune.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's the Roxy Bowie, you know, it was as precious British asshole as I got on the record, you know, and I can definitely do that.
I feel like we need another half an hour because it brings me to, I hear a lot of ELO.
Gotta love Jeff Lynne. Totally.
And Jeff, for me to compare you to Jeff Lynne is high praise indeed, because I fucking ELO.
I love ELO too, but ELO is like a good synthesis of everything that we like that he resynthesized, and then we are fans of that. So it's like getting all the iterations of his influences, and then it's surprising how, when you listen to their catalog. I'm just happy you got that deep into the record, because it's like,
yeah, that's side two, and there aren't even sides anymore.
Listen, that's another thing. So often bands front load a record. Right? The first six songs on a 12-song album, the first six songs are going to be fire. And then, well, we'll put the sleepy ones on the B-side. If this were vinyl, I think the B-side of the record is my favorite.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Amazing. It's really strong.
We did try. I mean, you have to front load nowadays. You have to, because no one gets, you just got to go. But it's,
right.
We fought about the order several times.
We get along through the whole record, and then when it's sequencing time, it's like ding 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 ding, and then we go out.
I had a different opener, but the record is literally 22 minutes aside.
Dave Way, who engineered and mixed it, you know, and then
the echo in the canyon stuff, you know,
and the echo in the canyon, a billion other Grammys. I think he just gets a Grammy every year just for showing up.
He does, literally. He's nominated. He does. I don't even think he had a record this year, and he got two Grammys.
And he's not, yeah. So yeah. Maybe next year we'll get lucky with him.
I've already got 15 songs. I keep throwing at Jordan going, we got more. And he's going, we just put out a record 4 days ago. And I go, I know, but, you know, Prince and Elvis Costello. And if it wasn't for two records a year and singles, we would probably not know who the Beatles were. Because if they put out records like Jerry and the Pacemakers, there'd be six records.
You could let Guided by Voices be your guiding star and put six or seven albums a year out.
Yeah. And then have us not get any of them.
And some of those voices tell me to do bad things. So, yeah.
Like putting out six or seven albums in one year.
Like putting out six in 1 year. Yeah.
Yeah. Jordan knows I'd love that. That's my
dream.
That's
a lot of posting.
You guys should have your own fucking podcast.
We do. This isn't ours.
We were going to thank you guys.
Thanks, Keith and Jeff, for being a part of the abandoned semi.
Incredible stories. Some guy pulls a gun on you in Birmingham. I would have loved to have heard that like 45 minutes ago.
Well, we'll write about it on the next album, and then Jeff will tell you about it.
Oh, Morty, I want to put a bow on this. To your point, around here we like to say, when it comes to listening to new bands, the mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open. Thank you for keeping the torch burning and continuing to write great music. It's going in somebody's ear holes and being enjoyed. So at least in Alabama, we appreciate you.
Well, you guys, you know,
thank you guys.
As we say, live long and just thank you. Keep listening. And if you're out there, feel better.
Yeah. There you go.
If you don't need it now, you're going to need it sometime.
Maybe Brent Spiner will finally bring your coffee.
Yeah, Ryan, come on, man. Jesus, I've been here for 31 years.
You don't tip, is why.
Jordan,
Morty, Jeff, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate
you. Thank you guys.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. You caught me just finishing up some editing on Getting Real with John and Beth. I want to share my first experience with Factor Meals for you. I think you'll find this interesting because I bet the same thing happens to you. I had just received my first shipment from Factor Meals the other day, and I was excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals for myself. Anyway, I was working away and noticed it was very late, and it was my night to make dinner. I jumped up and headed to the kitchen, went to grab the ingredients for the dish I was going to make, and realized I was missing a prime ingredient. Well, I could make a run to the store, or I could make one of my new factor meals. Actually, the choice was easy. I grabbed a cavatappi, an Italian-style pork ragu with garlic broccoli, heated the oven per instructions, and minutes later was enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. It really was everything Factor Meals said it would be. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off.
Many thanks to Jordan and Morty for their time and their stories. Extra special thanks to Dana Gordon for making it happen.
This episode of Abandoned Albums was written and produced by Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun. The show was recorded at Thunderlove Studio, where it was engineered by
Daphne Morris,
with help from
John Thomas.
Abandoned Albums was edited by
Mike Hunt.
Our theme song is Booty Cooler by Shuggy Otis. In the opening of the show, the songs you heard were Rumble by Link Ray, 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford, and the Carpenters classic Top of the World, performed by Shonen Knife. You can stream all of those songs and artists wherever you stream your favorite music.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
The songs you heard during this podcast were I'm Not Tired, Sweet Surprise, The Hell You Don't Know, The Man from The Big Pretend, Fathers of Daughters, and lastly, Hardly Any Wonder. You can stream All Day Sucker wherever you stream your favorite music. Be sure to check out our show notes for links to everything, well, most things mentioned in the podcast.
Please remember to support independent artists.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
Grazie.
Daily Leave.
Rob Janicki.
Mike Pellegrino.
Therina Vella.
Ronnie Barnett,
S.W. Loudon,
Michael Janicki,
Peyton Janicki,
and our executive producer.
This is Thunderwolf.
Abandoned Albums receives funding from Damon Pharmaceuticals, the makers of Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck is the only chewable tablet made to combat stomach unease associated with mediocrity. Taken daily, Ben Affleck can help combat explosive gastrointestinal shame. You can find a multitude of flavors in the incontinence section of your local pharmacy. Ben Affleck, save yourself the embarrassment.
The side effects include dry mouth, headache, anal leakage, muscle soreness, bad decisions, gender confusion, constipation, evil spirit possession, and banality. Use only as directed.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.